Well, we're returning to John's Gospel tonight for the next few weeks, in fact, really for most of the summer. And we seem to come back to John at quite an interesting moment, because here at the end of chapter 6 and into chapter 7, his popularity has turned to disappointment and desertion. Have a look back to verse 66 of chapter 6. After this teaching that Jesus had given, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. Disciples are deserting. Look down to verse 71. He says, verse 70, one of you is a devil, one of the twelve is a devil. He spoke of Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, for he, one of the twelve, was going to betray him. So disciples are deserting. One of the twelve is going to betray him. But as we go into chapter 7, things get no better. His own people are looking to kill him. Verse 1 of chapter 7, the Jews were seeking to kill him. And if you go on to verse 5, we discover that his family, not even his family, he can't rely on his family, because not even his family believe in him. We'd have to say, wouldn't we, things aren't going very well at this particular moment. So what do we do when things aren't going very well? Well, invariably, we'll look to change things, won't we? Let's have the first slide up, please, Alex. Nick, at the end of November, where were Plymouth Argyle in the First Division? Bottom. And there was considerable discussion, as well as the manager, Derek Adams, in the top right-hand corner there, was going to be sacked. That's, the forums were full of that, Nick, weren't they? Were you for sacking or were you for keeping? Keeping. You've got to say that now, haven't you? Of course you have. Because they kept the manager, and by the end of the season, they finished one place outside the playoffs. No change seemed to be the right answer when Plymouth were in trouble. What did Swansea City do? What did Stoke City do? What did West Bromwich Albion do? Well, they all made the change. They all changed their manager at least once during the season. But to no good effect. They all got relegated. Thanks, Alex. Take that away just for the moment. To change or not to change? When things aren't going well, what are you going to do? If your school gets a bad Ofsted, you're going to sack the head, you're going to get rid of the governors. If your company's annual report is bad, do you sack the chairman, do you sack the CEO, or do you leave the same team in place to move things on and to improve things? What do you do when things aren't going well? What should we do as a church if numbers are falling off a bit, if we don't seem to be getting as many new people through the doors, we're not seeing people turn to Jesus as we would like? Do we change things? Do we need a new message? Do we need new models of doing church? Do we need new media to attract people? To change or not to change? If to change, what should we change? Well, how does Jesus respond to these setbacks? How does he deal with things not going as well as they might do? Let's have the first heading up, please, Alex. So the first thing we need to be noticed is that Jesus will be rejected. And this was there at the very beginning of the gospel. In chapter 1, this is what you read. The true light, Jesus, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. And we see that worked through across the gospel. Rejection will come from the world at large. Rejection will come from Jesus' own people. And that is exactly what we see as we step in to chapter 7. So the first thing we need to notice is that the authorities want to kill Jesus. That's there, verse 1 of chapter 7. Jesus wouldn't go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now, the Jews in this section seem to be distinguished from the people in verses 12 and 13. They're different categories. And I think we need to understand the Jews as a phrase that John is using to talk about the Jewish leaders. We meet them back in chapter 5 and verses 16 to 18. And this is their reaction to Jesus healing a man on the Sabbath. This is why the Jews are persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." This is why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. You see their complaint. It's twofold. He's a Sabbath breaker, but worse than that, he's calling God Father, his own Father, and no Jew would have done that. As a people, they may have talked about God as Father, but not as individuals. And for those reasons, they're looking for him. You see that in verse 11. The Jews were looking for him at the feast. Now, that's looking with harmful intent. They're not just hoping to catch a coffee with him at some point during the feast. It's not that sort of thing at all, no. He's a marked man, and they want to make sure if he's there, they get him. That's their intention. And the reason being that Jesus is a challenge. He's a challenge to their religious system. He's a challenge to their status within the community. Because if what he said or implied about himself is true, then their system is bust. People are no longer going to look to them, look to the temple. Jesus is the one they will now look to. If he is Messiah, if he is king, if he's the only one who can bring them to God. Therefore, he must go. And for many through the years, Jesus has proved too challenging. Too disturbing. Maybe you're sitting here tonight thinking exactly that. There's much about being part of the St. John's family, part of your Bereans or roots or group, whatever it is that you like. But Jesus is quite a threatening figure. You'd quite like to domesticate him. You'd quite like to sort of use him for your own ends, to bring you the sort of the satisfaction and the sort of the good things that that seem to go with him. But you can't shrink Jesus down to that idol who will serve you. You can't shrink him to fit what you need and want. You can't make Jesus in your own image. And if you could, that no Jesus would be no help to you whatsoever. That's what it is to want to kill Jesus, to remove Jesus from the scene, to live your life without the real Jesus. Just another rejection. And then in verses 2 to 5, we see that the family do not believe in Jesus. Now, the Jews' feast of the booths was at hand. This was harvest festival to us. It was a 7-day feast festival with a special celebration on the 8th day. Happened end of September, beginning of October. And it was the most popular of the Jewish festivals. It was the one to which most people came. There was drawing of water, there was lighting of lights, it was all sort of great fun and lots of excitement. And it was called the Feast of Booths because when the people came up from the rural areas to stay in Jerusalem, they couldn't afford bed and breakfasts. There was none of these Airbnb sort of things that we would use these days. So they basically brought a few sticks, made a bit of a sort of a shelter and slept there. and that was called the booth. Now, the locals did the same. They went onto their flat roofs and did the same thing. Everybody joined in all together. It was all part of the fun. So it's a big occasion and a very happy occasion. So his brother said to him, verse 3, "Leave here and go to Judea so your disciples also may see the works you're doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." Now, his younger brothers may or may not have been aware that many disciples had deserted him. If you look at verse 1, they would certainly have been aware that he'd been kicking around at home a bit more than usual. So they come up with a plan to reignite his support, if you like, to restart his mission. They think he needs to meet the needs of his disciples or a new set of disciples by more miracles. And as the Feast of Booths is the biggest festival and it takes place in Jerusalem at the temple, the center of the nation, that's the obvious place to go, isn't it? Re-engage with people. Show yourself openly and draw people back to yourself. Now, some of you may well work in the area of marketing, and you would say, yeah, that's probably quite a good strategy. You've got to find a new market. You've got to engage with a new community in order to get your product out there. All publicity is good publicity. What's worse than everyone talking about you? No one talking about you. You need to turn things around, and this is the way to do it. But look at verse 5. "For not even his brothers believed in him." You see, this voice that's coming from Jesus' brothers is the voice of unbelief. They're saying, verse 4, "Show yourself to the world." Now, we heard from chapter 1 that the world is the one place that cannot receive Jesus, however much he might show himself to it. And so his brothers are stuck. They know Jesus can do miracles, but like so many others, they can't see what the miracles point to. They can't see the reality and the truth of the person that Jesus is. And there will always be that temptation for us to want to be popular, for us to do the things that will satisfy those outside of our walls, that will give us a better press, if you like, in their eyes. You'll have noticed how the world loves the fact that many churches have food banks. Many churches operate winter shelters. Those are good things. But of course, as soon as you want to use those as occasions to talk about Jesus, then you've moved the goalposts and the world is not happy at all. Now, our challenge, as Jesus will put it, is to be in the world but not of the world. To reach out to people, as Paul says, to be all things to all people, and yet not just to chase numbers. We've seen the end of chapter 6, how foolish that thought is. So we will not go out of our way to put obstacles between people and Jesus. But we will always make sure that it's the real Jesus that we're talking about. We're not going to change the message. We're not going to allow the fact that, yes, we'll serve coffee and it'll be sort of half-decent-ish sort of coffee. Yes, we'll use sort of PowerPoint and social media, and okay, the sound won't work sometimes, but that's what we'll do. We'll sing vaguely sort of contemporary music. Yes, we'll do that. But none of those things are more important than the message. We won't let those things control who we are or what we're going to do. Nothing is more important than the message. The real Jesus must be the heartbeat of who we are and what we do. So we're not going to set out to be popular. We're going to set out to follow this Jesus, to know him and to make him better known. And all the evidence is we will be rejected for that. Look on to verse 7. And here we find the motivation for rejecting Jesus. The world cannot hate you, that is, Jesus' brothers, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. You see, what the Jewish leaders and what Jesus' brothers have in common is that they belong to the world. And as we saw from chapter 1, the world cannot receive Jesus. In fact, the world hates Jesus. And the reason the world hates Jesus is given here, isn't it? Because Jesus tells the truth about the world. Jesus exposes the realities of worldly religion. Its works are evil. You see, Jesus is about life and light. We've had a lot about that in these opening chapters of the gospel, haven't we? And yet the world is about darkness and death. Evil flourishes in the dark. Evil always results in death. And as we know, Jesus' message is not a message of affirmation. Jesus doesn't say to you, you're doing fine, all is well. Jesus says to you, you've got to repent and believe. You've got to turn away from the way in which you think about the world, the way in which you think about me, the way in which you think about yourself. You've got to turn away from a lifestyle which rejects my word and my ways. You've got to turn from that to me. And anything which keeps you from doing that, any religion which promises you satisfaction in life apart from Jesus, well, that's evil. Any ideology which promises you a better world without Jesus, that is evil. And as we know, one thing our world hates is a truth teller. In 2003, 140 countries signed and ratified a United Nations Convention on Corruption. It was designed to protect whistleblowers, people who sought to expose corruption, particularly in the corporate world. Since then, Barclays, Wells Fargo, Enron, and Olympus have intentionally or unintentionally attempted to silence whistleblowers, punish them, or discredit them. Our world can't cope with truth tellers. Now, Line of Duty is one of my favourite TV cop shows. It's about the work of AC9, which is an anti-corruption unit within the police. And I know it's fiction, but the officers are constantly told that they're not doing proper police work. They're constantly told that they're hindering those who are trying to do proper police work. Nobody likes a truth teller. So it's no surprise, is it, that Jesus and those who follow him and speak the same message will be treated in this way. So Jesus speaks the truth. Jesus says there is no forgiveness apart from him. Jesus says there's no hope of eternal life apart from him. And unless you follow Jesus, you're lost now and for all eternity. The world hates Jesus because he tells the truth. And all who follow him and speak the same message can expect the same results. So what will Jesus' response or reaction to all this be then? Well, verses 6 to 10 tell us that Jesus will only act in accordance with the will of his Father. His point, you see, is that his brothers are free. They can go up to the feast whenever they like. My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. They're under no constraints whatsoever. It's festival time. They can go to the feast whenever they want. Now, you'll be aware that In John's Gospel, John will sometimes use the "my time has not yet come" language to refer to Jesus' cross and resurrection. But here, we haven't got to that point yet. Here, he's using this language of "my time" and "your time." He's saying it's a contrast between what the brothers are free to do, what Jesus isn't free to do. "You're going," he's saying, well, it's neither here nor there. You can go if you like, you don't go if you like. It doesn't really matter, does it? But my life must conform to my Father's will. I am constrained by what he wants for me. So in verse 19 of chapter 5, we read these words. Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise." Now, we might say, well, of course, it's sensible, isn't it? After all, if Jesus goes to the feast too soon, there's more risk of him being arrested. And it's not the time for that yet. But that's not what John tells us at this point. Jesus does go to the feast. Look at verse 10. After his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. And over the next couple of weeks, we'll see what he does when he goes. But the point here is that Jesus is in control. He's not going to allow his brothers nor the religious leaders to determine how he behaves, where he goes, or when he goes and does what he does. He will do that as he seeks to obey the will of his Father. Jesus is in control of his own destiny. Let's look at the final couple of verses. There's another group here, the people. And the people have yet to make up their minds about Jesus. Now, John has been very helpful to us in that at the end of his gospel, he tells us why he wrote it. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. When Jesus was on earth, he said, "Life is in me. Come to me for life. Come to me for satisfaction. Come to me to be fed. Come to me for your thirst to be quenched." And despite the setbacks at the end of chapter 6 and here at the beginning of chapter 7, that is still the plan and the intention then and now. So we're always left with the next question. Well, fair enough, but what are the people going to make of it? Well, first of all, we notice the threat posed by the religious leaders. Verse 13. "Yet for fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of Jesus." It's just the same as in Harry Potter. You can't say Voldemort, can you? You're not allowed to mention Jesus. For goodness sake, don't do that. But I guess people were thinking about Jesus in private. Yes, they would have been discussing Jesus. And here is what they're thinking. Verse 12. "There was much muttering about him among the people. Some said, 'He is a good man.'" After all, he's healed people. How can healing people be a bad thing to do? How can the person who does a good thing like healing people be a bad person? Very simple. And, but don't mention this out loud, some people think he's the Messiah anyway. Others, however, said, "No, he's leading the people astray. He is a deceiver." And that, Jesus being a deceiver, became the party line after the resurrection. That is what Judaism has continually said about Jesus since then. He was a deceiver, lying about his relationship with God, lying about the power by which he healed people, lying about who he was and what he came to do. And that's a good question for us to answer, isn't it? Particularly if you're sitting here tonight as someone who hasn't yet put their trust in Jesus. Read through John's Gospel. Decide, what do you make of him? Good man or deceiver? Come to real life next week and just see how this develops. On the back of the sheet, I've given you the famous quotation from C.S. Lewis about why you might come to certain conclusions as to who Jesus is. Let's not pretend that this isn't an outrageous claim. But let's acknowledge with Lewis what Jesus won't let us say, that Jesus was just a good person, a great teacher. So said the things he did say cannot lead you to that conclusion. Either he's a lunatic or he's God. What conclusion will the people reach? Well, we'll see that over the next few weeks. What conclusion will you reach? So as we go back to where we started, what are we going to change, if anything? Well, we don't need a new saviour. We don't need a new message. But yes, we probably do need to look at the way in which we do things and the things that we do in order that Jesus may be better known. The church has constantly changed throughout its history, and we mustn't be afraid to do that today. But we will never change the one we serve.